Hey guys, and welcome to the first ever episode of A Walk on the Wild Side, a veterinary podcast designed to educate veterinary professionals and other animal lovers on all things wildlife, zoo, and exotics. I'm your host, Kyle Kansman, a third-year veterinary student at Michigan State University. Today, I'll be sitting down to talk with the outstanding Dr. Stephanie Lewis, a wildlife veterinarian I had the amazing opportunity to work with last summer in California, and we'll be talking about the incredibly important topic of anticoagulant rodenticides. Hi, Dr. Lewis, and thank you for joining me today on the first ever episode of A Walk on the Wild Side.
Kyle, thanks so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So I've been lucky enough to have had the opportunity to learn from you and get to know you as a mentor. But for all those listening, do you mind telling them a little bit about yourself, what you do, and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. So I grew up as a kid always wanting to be a vet, but I wanted to actually be an equine veterinarian. So I was like a little horse girl. And I did a wildlife internship during undergrad between junior and senior year of college, just for something different to put on my vet school applications. And I ended up totally falling in love with it. It was like the happiest I've ever been. Really passionate about just like the mission of wildlife rehab and excited about like working with the different species. Was still very much of the mindset that like, I'm going to be an equine vet. That's what I always wanted to do. But I ended up kind of did some other wildlife internships and just kind of was like, Like, I think I can make a career out of this. I think I want to try to make a career out of it. You know, and then I ended up going to Tufts University in Massachusetts for a vet school. I chose them because they have a really outstanding wildlife program. We had a wildlife clinic on campus, made good use of all my summers. I worked at a couple other rehab centers during summers and elective time, you know, during clinics. And then after I graduated vet school, I did a small animal rotating medicine and surgery internship at Michigan State University. And it was a very difficult year, but I'm very glad that I did it because it's really important to get those medicine and surgical, you know, skills and those basics down because a lot of those things I do apply to my wildlife medicine, you know, my wildlife patients. And so after that internship, I did a wildlife internship for another year at Tufts University. And after I finished that, I worked for a little bit on Long Island doing exotic pet medicine and small animal emergency for about like 8 months or so before I found my job at California Wildlife Center. And I was there for about 2.5 years and kind of a little bit of everything. Like we did lots of birds and mammals. We also did some marine mammals. You know, I suddenly found myself being a sea lion vet, which I never thought I would. I'm currently the veterinarian at Ojai Raptor Center, which is also a little bit more my speed. It's lots of raptors and birds primarily, which I enjoy the most for sure. So that's where I am currently.
And something I want to point out that you talked about too is how you always thought you were going to be an equine vet from the start. But I think it's so cool that people can find another passion later on in their schooling or even in their career. And now it's awesome that you can do wildlife, and even though it's quite a bit different.
Yeah, very different. Yeah, you just have to be flexible. And I kind of reasoned, I was like, you know, like I kind of like horses as my escape from work rather than my actual work. So
yeah.
You know, I was like, I love birds. I want to work with birds. And so that's the way I had to do it.
All right. So let's jump right into anticoagulant rodenticides. So to start it off, can you explain what anticoagulant rodenticides are?
Sure. Anticoagulant rodenticide is a fancy way to say rat poison and referring to a specific kind of rat poison. And it causes death to rodents by inhibiting their body's ability to clot their blood. And the reason we have a problem with it is that non-target species are actually exposed to those rodenticides by eating the rodents that have eaten the bait. And so there's a there's two kind of broad classes of anticoagulants. One is the first generations, which, as the name implies, were the first ones to be invented. And that includes compounds like warfarin, which is actually a medication used often in human medicine. My grandfather used to take warfarin. They'll refer to it as a blood thinner, right? And so the big difference in these versus the second generations, which are the ones that came later, and they were introduced in like the 1970s in response to rodents becoming resistant to the first generations, is that the first generations do not accumulate in the liver and they have a shorter half-life in the body. The second generations, which are things like rodificum, bromodiolone, difethylone, those are more highly toxic to the non-target species because they do accumulate in the liver and they have a really long half-life.
Awesome. Thank you. So why do you think anticoagulant rodenticides are such a relevant problem in veterinary medicine? And which animals would you say are primarily affected by these substances?
Yeah, it's a huge problem because the range of different kinds of species that can be impacted is pretty huge. Because we also see it in dog and cat medicine. You know, when I was an intern, I can't even tell you how many dogs I saw that ingested a bag of anticoagulants. So we see it in multiple species, and then in wildlife, we see it in our predator species. So primarily raptors, as well as species like coyotes, bobcats, and mountain lions. So these are all animals that are not necessarily, they're not eating the bait themselves. They're eating rodents that have previously ingested the bait. And it's not that they're eating, one affected mouse and then they get sick. It's that they are eating over a period of time, multiple rodents that have ingested the bait and slowly over time building up their levels of these compounds until they develop a coagulopathy and aren't able to clot their blood.
All right, so now that we've got a better idea of what anticoagulant rodenticides are, can you describe how these rodenticides work?
Yes. So this is when remembering your clotting cascade is helpful. So they inhibit the activation of factors 2, 7, 9, and 10. That's a board question. You should try to remember that for Navly and stuff. But those factors 2, 7, 9, and 10 are your vitamin K dependent clotting factors.
She isn't joking that vet students get asked that all the time. So one helpful way that I remember it, as corny as it may be, is from a phrase I made up. So what you can remember is factors 2, 7, 9, and 10. Without vitamin K, you'll bleed again. All right, now that I've put that out there, let's get back to listening.
And what the anticoagulants do is they block an enzyme that's in the liver called vitamin K epoxide reductase. And so what that enzyme usually does is takes vitamin K from its inactive form and converts it to its active form. So the active form of vitamin K is then used by the clotting factors to perform whatever function they need to do. So when we're not able to convert the vitamin K to its active form, those clotting factors are no longer able to do their job.
All right, so if animals then post-ingestion of anticoagulant rodenticides have impaired coagulation, and just to review from inhibition of vitamin K epoxide reductase, then how are these animals with this poisoning presenting?
Yeah, so they're presenting with a secondary hemostatic disorder. So remember, your primary hemostatic disorders are, problems with your platelets. So that's like when you have like more mucosal bleeding. So when we have secondary hemostatic disorders, that's when we have hemorrhage into potential spaces. So you have hemorrhage into your pleura, your peritoneum, your lungs, your retroperitoneum, even like your sub-Q space, your joints, that kind of thing. The signs are a bit delayed. So, in dogs, you usually have about 3 to 5 days post-ingestion before they develop clinical signs. And that's because of the you have to wait for the consumption of those clotting factors to occur, because they're still going to have some active clotting factors available. But your factor 7 is the one with the shortest half-life. So that means your PT that you're testing for is going to elevate first, and usually about 36 to 48 hours after ingestion. So in cats and dogs, usually we see like pulmonary hemorrhage, hemothorax, hemoabdomen, and, you know, several days after ingestion. In raptors, I find, you know, more often, and whether this be just because, you know, maybe a lot of wildlife centers don't have ultrasound, or like it's hard to ultrasound birds because of their air sac, but we find more like superficial bruising. And it may also be because our wildlife species are just being like, you know, they have a little rougher life than our dogs and cats that are laying on the couch all day. You know, they're out there, they're hunting, they're looking for prey, and maybe like getting bumped, you know, running into things and stuff. So I see a lot of superficial bruising, which in birds, you have to kind of like part the feathers and maybe wet down the feathers with alcohol to see the bruising, as well as like an abnormally large amount of bleeding from a wound. So if you have a bird that presents and it's like, it has like a massive amount of dried blood on its feathers somewhere, but you go and look for, you're like, oh my God, this must be a terrible wound. And you look for it and it's like a tiny little laceration that's like 3 millimeters. Like you should, like alarm bell should be going off, because that's way too much blood than should be there. So that's kind of mostly things I'm seeing. You can also have, you know, I do see as primarily necropsy, like pulmonary hemorrhage, bleeding into the air sacs. I've even seen them bleeding into their eyeballs. Like I think, you know, just from head trauma and the pectin, which is the blood vessels at the back of bird's eye, that starts bleeding, and then they get massive bleeding, you know, into their posterior chamber, like way more than what I would normally expect. So it can be, yeah, bleeding anywhere.
Now, I know that you had said, at least for birds, one of the more common signs is the superficial bruising. Now, can you see or use that bruising almost to figure out a timeline at all as to when these animals ingested the rodenticide because of that typical color change that you'd see in bruises in birds around like 3 to 5 days?
No, it's hard because it's usually multiple exposures over time. And on necropsy, a lot of these birds are, you know, and not just birds, but, you know, coyotes and things like that too. They're exposed to sometimes 3-4 different rodenticides. So it's really hard. And we don't really know what the toxic, what the lethal dose is or the toxic dose is for all these different species. You know, I think we do for some domestics, but we don't necessarily for our wildlife. So it can be hard to know how long they've been bleeding. Usually by the time they actually get to the clinic, I would suspect that many of them have been bleeding for days, because usually their PCV is like less than 10 before they actually come in, you know, because when they're kind of hovering around 20% or whatever, they still have the, you know, the wherewithal to fly away from people if they're able to. So they're not going to be caught. So when they are caught, usually they're kind of like 8%, 5%, 2%, and they're kind of in that kind of PCV range before they come in.
So when Dr. Lewis is saying PCV, she's talking about the packed cell volume, which is essentially a representative value for the amount of red blood cells within the animal's blood. And to give it some perspective, a normal PCV for a bird is around 38% to somewhere near the mid-40s. So a bird with a PCV of less than 10% has lost a lot of their red blood cells and is severely anemic.
The bruises do change color over time. So birds, if you remember, bruise green, they lack an enzyme called biliverdin reductase. So, you know, when their bruise is like 3 to 5 days old, usually, kind of depending on, it can be longer if it's really severe bruising. But in a normal bird, at least, you know, after about 3 to 5 days, it turns this like beautiful teal color. So in those situations, you can tell how long it's been.
So
Let's say now that you've had a clinical suspicion of anticoagulant redundancy poisoning. So how are you going to go about diagnosing anticoagulant redundancy toxicosis? Because I can imagine it being a little bit more difficult to definitively identify in wildlife with kind of minimal history and limited diagnostic options.
Yeah, it is a lot more difficult in wildlife. So in dogs and cats, you know, you can run your coagulation panel, your PT, PTT, but we don't have that available to us, especially for birds. It might work, you know, if I had a coyote or a bobcat with a suspicion, it may work for them. But with birds, you would need avian thromboplastin to run those exams. So your commercially available PT, PTT won't work on them. So if I have a bird that presents, or really any animal that presents, you know, in good body condition, but with a very low PCV, like a hematocrit of, you know, less than 10, but good body condition, you know, not really finding any other, you know, major problems, except for maybe bruising, you know, whatever, minor trauma, that puts my suspicion way up for rodenticides. So what I'll do aside from getting a hematocrit is I'll also draw a small amount of blood and put it in a red top tube, just like a little tube with no additives. And a normal bird usually collapses in like 3 to 5 minutes, maybe 10, you know, just with that blood in the tube and, you know, every once in a while, rock it back and forth. For the rodenticide cases, majority of them that I'm seeing, it's like the next day and it's still just liquid in there. So obviously, you know, when I see that, I'm like, you know, this has got to be what this is. So I'll start treating, you know, get them on vitamin K, and if they're anemic, which they usually are, you know, possibly a whole blood transfusion. You know, and even if you're not so sure, maybe they're not that anemic, vitamin K is a pretty benign treatment. So, you know, you can't really overdose on it. There's no adverse effects. So it's not harmful to just start them on vitamin K.
Yeah. And I think that just goes to show too, that if the blood isn't even clotting within a day, how just drastic this can be for them if they get kind of exposed to this out in the wild and they're just bleeding out for a day or so.
Yeah. And I think we're not seeing nearly as many of cases as there actually are out there, because, you know, these animals are going to be able to hide, you know, just like your cat, when they're really sick, goes and hides in the closet. You know, these animals are not going to be, you know, walking onto somebody's front yard and being like, hey, I'm not feeling well. They're going to be hiding somewhere and likely just going to be dying alone, hidden. So I think the likelihood that we're actually seeing, you know, even close to the number of animals that are affected, is pretty slim, especially considering mortality studies, just looking at birds of prey or coyotes, bobcats, mountain lions that have died or euthanized for any reason, you know, unrelated to any kind of coagulopathy, if they're euthanized for any reason, and where different researchers have tested for anticoagulants in the liver. It's something, you know, depending on the study, it's anywhere from like 88% have had exposure to 96%, you know, to some, you know, in some cases like 100%, depending on, you know, where these animals are found. So the exposure out there is just massive. And, you know, at a busy rehab center, you know, we're getting maybe 12 to 20 a year or so out of like 4,000 animals. So I think it's way more widespread than what we're seeing in the clinic, unfortunately.
Yeah. All right. So let's say, thankfully, that we've now have a patient that has made it to the clinic, and then you've now diagnosed anticoagulant redundancy toxicosis. What are some of your main targets for treatment then of this type of poisoning?
Sure. Yeah. So I do like to, you know, kind of compare about what we can do for dogs and cats and what we can do for wildlife. So if we were treating a dog or cat and we had a known recent ingestion, so we know they ingested it within the past 3 hours, we can induce emesis, you know, make them vomit it up. And if it's within the past 8 to 12 hours, we can give them activated charcoal. Obviously, we can't do that. in our wildlife species because the ingestion happened ages ago, you know, likely not within the past 8 to 12 hours, because we know it takes them several days to start bleeding and then several days after that before they're sick enough to be brought in. So those are off the table. Our other treatments in dogs and cats are either plasma or whole blood. So plasma, if they have a coagulopathy, but they're not anemic yet, they don't need those red cells because we want to replenish the clotting factors. So the plasma is going to contain those clotting factors. And then whole blood, because it'll have the plasma in it, in addition to the red cells, if they are anemic. And then crystalloids, you know, if we're done our transfusions, you know, start them on fluids. You will see in some kind of older textbooks that advise not to give crystalloids to patients that are anemic because you like hemodilute them. You'll kind of hear that thing. That's not really the case. Like, yes, if you give, like, say you don't have blood, you don't have whole blood or plasma, you should still give crystalloids to an anemic animal because, you know, yes, like your PCV, you know, when you measure it, will probably go down after giving those fluids, but your overall tissue perfusion and delivery of oxygen nutrients to your cells is going to improve. So your perfusion and blood pressure will improve if you give crystalloids. So still go ahead and give that. And, you know, our mainstay of therapy is vitamin K. The vitamin K, however, takes about 24 hours to restore hemostatic ability. So in the meantime, that's why we need things like plasma or whole blood to restore some clotting factors and stop them from bleeding. Because otherwise, when we just have crystalloids and vitamin K, they're still going to bleed for the next day or so. And a lot of times when I lose my rodenticide patients, it's within that first kind of 12 to 24 hour range where I'm like just waiting for my crystalloids or my vitamin K to work. And hoping, you know, my fluids keep them going. But so with wildlife, I do often have the option. So we know that emesis and activated charcoal are off the table. Vitamin K and crystalloids, I absolutely can do. And I do have the option of giving whole blood if I have a suitable donor. So the nice thing with birds is that they don't have any naturally occurring antibodies to blood types. So I can give a blood transfusion to a bird and not have to worry really about transfusion reactions or, you know, typing and cross-matching because I can pretty safely assume that they've never had a transfusion before. I think that's usually a safe assumption for wildlife. So that's something that I will often do is do a whole blood transfusion. And you can actually, you know, ideally you use the same species, but you can transfuse any species to any other species of bird. Like I can give an owl goose blood or, you know, vice versa. The red cells will last a little bit longer if you use the same species though. So I try to use the same species.
Yeah, and that's just incredible. That was one of the questions I was actually thinking about. So you hit it, but that's so cool that you can just go across species because you just think about how in dogs and cats, how much different it is when you're thinking about giving blood transfusions, the steps that you need to take kind of before that. But so at least one positive.
Yeah, one thing that's a little bit simpler.
All right. So since this is a near and dear topic to your heart, do you have a case example that you would like to go through for us and for all those that are listening?
Sure. Yeah, I have the case example that I always use, which is a red-tailed hawk, which is probably the most common raptor species that I get and probably one of the more commonly exposed to rodenticides. Mm-hmm. So you get, you know, you're at a wildlife center and you get presented with an adult red-tailed hawk and your history, all you get is that it's unable to fly. That's usually all the history that you ever get. And, you know, maybe it was, you know, found at the side of a road in an urban area and was transferred to you from a local veterinarian. And then your exam, the bird is cold to the touch. She's dull. She's pretty minimally responsive. You know, usually these birds are trying to actively get away from you and, you know, they're terrified of you, but she's hardly reactive at all. You look at her mucous membranes and, you know, in her mouth, and she's quite pale. They should be a nice, you know, bright pink color. you look at her cutaneous ulnar vein on the medial aspect of her ulna, proximally, just distal to the elbow, and that you press on that vein, and you can kind of, it's really tiny. It's like the size of a thread, and you can actually like see it fill. So that tells you that she's like seriously dehydrated, but she's in very good body condition. You know, she's an adult female, and she's 1.2 kgs, which is perfectly, you know, good, robust size for a female red-tailed hawk. Do a quick radiograph, and that's nothing obvious. Obviously, you know, not a sedated radiograph, just like kind of toss her on the plate and take an image. Then you find some bruising over her ventral body wall musculature, which, as I said, is quite common. And then on her right shoulder, maybe she has like a tiny little laceration, and there's a bunch of blood around it, and it's still kind of oozing blood. So, as you know, you should know by now that all these should set alarm bells in your head. This is probably rodenticide. so you take a little bit of blood. Your PCV is like 8%, you know, which normally birds should be in kind of 38 to mid 40s. So she's quite anemic. Her total solids are a little bit low as well at 2. You know, normal in birds should be 3 to 5 grams per deciliter.
So I wanted to quick interject an important point based off her PCV and total solids for any of the veterinary professionals listening in. Both her PCV and total solids were low, which that right there should key you into that this bird's anemia is very likely a result of blood loss. So remember, blood loss is non-selective, and I don't know why I just made actual air quotes with my hands as if you could even see me, but anyway, with blood loss, you'll see low amounts of red blood cells and proteins because everything is being lost out of the vasculature. Now, this rule isn't always true, just like most things in veterinary medicine, but it's a good thing to remember. All right, let's get back to the case.
And then you put a little bit of tube in your red top tube, or a little bit of blood in your red top tube. And like 20 minutes later, it's still not clotted. You know, and the next day, it's still probably not clotted. So the first thing that I'm going to do, you know, I've just got this bird. I'm pretty sure it's rodenticide. I'm going to give her just, you know, real quick, so I can just get things started. I'm going to give her sub-Q fluids. I'm going to give her vitamin K. And I usually start at about 5 mg/kg sub-Q. I'll put a little pressure bandage over that wound if I can. And then I'm going to stick her in an oxygen cage. So my next step would be I would like to transfuse this bird, right? If I can. So in this case, I do have a potential donor. I have a red-tailed hawk that's in the flight pen. So I brought her in. So I do a sterile prep. I pull my blood. So you can, you know how much blood you can safely take from an animal?
Ooh, I want to say like 1 gram or like one something. Jeez, I really should remember that.
And yeah, I should have remembered it, but I wanted to say that to anyone listening that it's also okay to not know everything. If you're in a situation like this where it's pretty low stakes, it's okay to take a chance and guess. And if you're wrong, like I was, then it's okay. I know I was never comfortable with being wrong, and it took a while, but just shake it off, learn from it, and get it the next time.
So 1% of their body weight. So if you have, because their blood volume is approximately 10% of their body weight, and then you can safely take about 10% of the blood volume. So 1% of body weight. So if I have a 1 kilogram bird, which is what most red-tailed hawks weigh, I can take 10 mils of blood. So you have to keep in mind, though, like if you have, like, say you cause a hematoma while you're drawing the blood, like that still counts as blood loss. So you have to, you know, be cognizant of that. but anyway, so I pulled my 10 mils of blood. I want to keep it warm afterwards. So I have a little fluid warmer. I'll stick it on the fluid warmer. And then I'm going to get my recipient bird ready. And you can give blood either intravenously or intraosseously. So in birds, typically we'll use either the ulna, the distal ulna, or the proximal tibia tarsus for intraosseous fluids, which in a lot in these severely dehydrated animals is usually honestly easier than trying to get an IV catheter in. And again, I do a sterile prep of my catheter site. I get my catheter in, I secure it, and I, since I like the ulna, I'll put a figure eight on that thigh, on the wing, so wing wrap, and then kind of do like a little like butterfly tape tabs on the end of the cap of the needle, my needle that's in the bone, and then tape that to my figure eight.
Before you go on too, so if you are doing the intraosseous route, then I'm sure with birds having pneumatic bones that there's certainly bones you'd have to avoid if you're going to do that, right?
Yes, very good point. So the in most bird species, the humerus and the femur are the long bones that are pneumatic. So that means pneumatic means that they are hollow and air-filled, and they actually are directly communicating with the air sacs. So if I gave my fluids or blood transfusion into a humerus, I would then, like, the bird would drown in that. So obviously we don't want to do that. You do have to be careful because there are some species variability in that. So, you know, if you're working with like a rat tite or a, like a penguin, I don't think they have any pneumatic bones, but if you're working with a pelican, basically all their bones are pneumatic. Pelicans are super weird. They're like different in every way. But yeah, so like all of their bones are pneumatic. So you, and they have sub-Q air sacs everywhere. So you can't even give them sub-Q fluids. You can only do oral or IV in a pelican, but you, they have nice pouch veins that you can get an IV catheter in. So, but anyways, but I digress. So in case you ever work with a pelican, they're super weird. So getting back to our patients. Once you're done your transfusion, you can go ahead and switch them over to crystalloids. You know, if your catheter is still patent and you have a fluid pump, go ahead and start them on crystalloids. And then you're going to keep going with that vitamin K. I'll initially have them on vitamin K sub-Q like three times a day, and then gradually back up. Like once they're more stable, they really just need about 2.5 mix per kg orally once a day. But initially I'll kind of put them on, you know, a little higher dose. So do you know in dogs and cats, do you remember how long you're supposed to keep them on vitamin K for?
Ooh, I want to say it's a couple weeks.
It's 4 weeks. The whole month, and that's because of the really long half-life of the anticoagulant. So in this case, you know, when they get that blood, this bird actually, while she was receiving her blood transfusion, she perked up quite a bit and started to like chew on her line, you know. So I actually had to put a falconry hood on her, and she kind of like stood there quietly because the falconry hoods, you know, are there to decrease visual stimuli. Yeah, so once her transfusion was done, she like felt way better. You know, we took the catheter out. I didn't keep her on it overnight because she had proved clinically pretty significantly. And the next morning, her PCV had actually gone up to, I think it was like 16%, like it more than doubled. And that was even with fluids and everything too. So yeah, and birds can tolerate quite a bit of blood loss and produce red cells a little bit faster. So that's, you know, maybe, you know, if this was a dog or cat or a coyote or something, you might not see such a profound improvement. But yeah, she looked really excellent the next morning. I even got a text from one of my technicians and she described her as salty that morning. And she like ate her mouse right away. You know, it was a world of difference from when she presented. So we were really happy with that. We still, even though we don't quite know the half-life of second generations in birds, we still keep them on vitamin K for a full four weeks, like we do in dogs and cats. And in dogs and cats, you check a PT about 72 hours after your last dose of vitamin K. So if it's normal, you can stop your vitamin K. If it's a little prolonged, you would continue it. In births, I just, you know, I take some blood in my tube. Obviously, I want to recheck their PCV, you know, make sure they should be in like their at least the low 40s. and just make sure that's clotted. And then in this case, she clotted in, you know, about 3 minutes or so, as she should have. And so, you know, after I discontinued her vitamin K, so once she stopped the vitamin K, we just kept her, exercised her in the Big Flight for a couple weeks, and then she was released. And the people who found her and brought her in got to take her and release her, so they were really excited about that and sent us some videos and stuff. So it was a nice outcome.
Yeah, no, and that's awesome with the happy ending. And it's also really cool that we can kind of involve the people that were the initial ones that bring in this bird too. And just because it is, we need people to volunteer and bring animals in, or else they could kind of just pass away on their own. So that's awesome though. It kind of is a nice, happy full circle.
Yeah.
All right. So it seems like anticoagulant rodenticides have continued to be kind of this daunting issue in veterinary medicine. And one, as you've said before, kind of crosses many fields within vet med, including our domestic animals. So what, if anything, has been done to try and mitigate this risk of non-target species ingesting anticoagulant rodenticides, and kind of what are some of the other non-target species that you're seeing affected by this?
Also, before we hear her answer, you'll notice some tapping noise in the background. Those are Dr. Lewis's dogs, who apparently wanted to make a special guest appearance while recording. So hopefully you enjoy their tabbed dance routine while listening.
Yeah, so it is a huge problem. And there has been some legislation done to decrease the availability of these compounds. One was, I think, in 2011, the EPA restricted them for commercial use. So before that, you could go to a grocery store and just pick up a big old bag of Brodificum. You know, it was usually under, most commonly under the name of Decon. But yeah, you can just bring home a whole bag of it. That's no longer allowed. Only professional pest control companies can access it. And I think what's most important is education, and educating people in the effects of these compounds and alternatives. So if you go on, actually, Poison Free Malibu is a good resource. They have a lot of different, like, more natural alternatives. And honestly, probably, you know, live traps or even like snap traps are a lot more humane and less damaging to our environment than putting these poisons out. And there's other deterrents. There's actually certain plants that they don't like. Like, I think they don't like mint or lavender, you know, that rodents kind of avoid, because we're seeing these, you know, it's not just, you know, I talked a lot about raptors, but we're seeing them more often in other non-target species, that like large carnivorous mammals. And it's not just the effect of the anticoagulants directly. We're seeing effects on their immune system health that's making them more susceptible to other diseases. So there seems to be a link between anticoagulant rodenticides and mange, particularly in bobcats. It appears to be potentially that way in coyotes and mountain lions too. But in bobcats, Dr. Seth Riley, who's a researcher for the National Park Service in California, he and his group have done multiple studies, and they've detected anticoagulants in 90% of all bobcats, you know, in this area in Southern California. 77% of them had like multiple anticoagulants, like different kinds of anticoagulants. And in this one study, they had 19 bobcats that died of severe mange. 100% of those bobcats had anticoagulant exposure. And they repeated it again and again, 100% of the bobcats with severe mange had anticoagulant exposure. So what they think is happening is that the anticoagulants may be somehow altering gene expression and reducing their immune system health. And then that's resulting in mange. In bobcats, we see notoedric mange, which has been in the population of bobcats. Like, they've had it, it's kind of endemic, it's, you know, normally in the population, but didn't cause any mortality. And now all of a sudden they're getting severe notoedric mange, and it's, you know, affecting their whole body, and it's, you know, they're developing severe emaciation and hypothermia and eventually dying from this disease that previously you know, didn't cause a problem. So that's why I think, you know, so these compounds are affecting animals in ways that we never even dreamed about, you know. So, you know, it may, who knows what else we might find in the future, you know.
Yeah, and I remember seeing firsthand too when I was working with you in California, just how devastating kind of the mange became on one bobcat that came in, who ended up unfortunately passing away. But it was just, it just took over completely just because of kind of the secondary effects then of the anticoagulant. So yeah, it's definitely a serious problem. So it's, I'm glad that we've kind of had the chance here to hopefully change some things and educate people on kind of just how big of an issue this can be.
Yeah, it's devastating, and unfortunately, with those kind of species, with bobcats especially, they have to be so sick for them to allow themselves to be caught. So we don't get those animals until they're basically about to pass away, and it's a devastating and awful way to die. You know, no matter how they die of these poisons, it's a terrible way to pass away. So.
Yes, well. Hopefully with this and kind of further education for other people and stuff, we can start to make a change for that. So thank you so much, Dr. Lewis, for talking on this incredibly important topic. And you've given us some really, really important information on anticoagulant rodenticide poisoning. So before I let you go, though, what would you say are kind of the few most important points for us to remember here when managing anticoagulant rodenticide toxicosis?
As like a veterinarian or as a, like a member of the public?
Let's do both. Why not?
So as a veterinarian, I think, you know, most important is to have it in the back, like always be suspecting it, you know, always have it in the back of your mind and be worried about it. Because even in California, even though, you know, supposedly it's going to be way less prevalent, and I hope it is, I don't know. You know, I hope that people don't need this information in a few years, but they might. So always suspect it, you know, treat it aggressively. You know, I don't give up on them either. I mean, I've had patients with PCV. I think my lowest during my internship, we had one that came in with a PCV of 2% and she made it. So, you know, they're incredibly resilient. And then for members of the public, check if you hire a pest control company, check your box, check those bait boxes that they're putting out. You know, I mean, really no poison is a safe poison, and other poisons that they might be putting out could have effects on, you know, species that you know, don't necessarily want to kill. So, you know, follow up with your, you know, pest control companies that you hire. If you live in a condo complex or apartment complex, like write, you know, be like me and write angry letters to your HOA or, you know, your the people that manage your apartment complex. You know, educate people, you know, in your community, your family members, write letters to your senators and your, you know, your state representatives and things like that, just to get some things changed, because, you know, this definitely it needs to be taken care of, and, you know, it's a lot of people don't know about it.
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely got to stay resilient and stay informed. So, yep. Well, thank you. Thank you so much for talking. And it's been great to kind of have you on. And especially as my first guest, I wouldn't have wanted anyone else.
No problem. Thanks, Kyle. Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, everyone, for listening in. And I hope you enjoyed today's episode. For updates on upcoming episodes and additional information on all things wildlife, zoo, and exotics, follow us on Instagram at walkonthewildside_vetpodcast and like us on Facebook. Thanks again for tuning in, and I hope you join us for the next episode of A Walk on the Wild Side.